It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up in today's world, how much money you make determines a lot of things, including the people you're most likely to interact with. A sociologist tells us how growing economic inequalities are changing our society. First, a lot of us have pets. And with so many people working from home at least part of the time over the last year and a half or so, we've been seeing more of our animal friends than we would otherwise. In some cases, we're doing a better job noticing when something seems wrong with them. That's good. Problem is that animal hospitals and veterinarians are swamped in many cases, and they're often having a hard time keeping up. Plus, many places are short-staffed, and there's a lot of turnover. For pet owners, that means longer wait times for appointments. The pandemic has also caused other disruptions, like not being able to go inside with your animals. Some people have gotten angry. One veterinarian near Los Angeles told The Guardian that an irate client threw a milkshake at the front window. Our next guest says veterinarians and their staffs are doing their best and has some advice for pet owners to make things go more smoothly. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What has been your experience dealing with veterinary care during the pandemic? Do you feel like help is there when you need it? How hard has it been tending to your pet's medical needs? If you work at a vet clinic or animal hospital, what's the past year and a half been like for you? What do you want pet owners to understand the most? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Joelle Carson is the executive director for the Wisconsin Veterinary Medical Association. Joelle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob. I'm happy to be here.
We read in some national publications that vets and their staff have been under a lot of stress during the pandemic for a variety of reasons. Big picture, is that something you've been seeing from your colleagues around the state?
That's definitely something that we've been seeing and hearing quite frequently since the pandemic hit. And like everybody, everybody's feeling different types of stresses, and those come out in different types of ways. For our practices here in the state of Wisconsin, we right away were essential workers, but only for urgent care pets. So what happened was it created this backlog of preventative care, the rabies shots that needed to happen, the Lyme and tick disease shots that needed to happen. All of those got put on hold and urgent care was seen. So as we've, and then of course we had curbside and we had sanitizing and all of these different things that we've become accustomed to in our grocery stores, our restaurants, and everywhere that we go, it's created this break in the supply chain. Except I think it's just not as obvious to see. I think as people go into the grocery store and they don't see hand sanitizer there, they say, oh, it's a break in the supply chain. But we don't always recognize that in our service industries.
How much have you caught up with that backlog in the pet care, the veterinary industry? Or are we still there?
We're still there. We're still playing catch up, and we're playing catch up quite a bit. It's really interesting. Our American Veterinary Medical Association dug into the numbers more to look at what we've been hearing that, oh, there's so many pets being adopted and there's a shortage of veterinarians and there's an increase in vet visits. What was interesting to find out is that pet adoptions are actually down. They're the lowest that they've been in 5 years. And we've seen an increase in service appointments, but what's happening is those appointments are taking longer because you used to go in and talk to your veterinarian while they were visiting with your pet, while they were checking your pet. Now they're checking your pet and then they're coming out to talk with you. So what we've seen is the pandemic has brought this huge decrease in how efficient we can be in our clinics, which has made the backlog increase. I think as restrictions have lifted in different areas, we're working to catch up, but we're definitely not there yet.
And we see many, many lines of work saying they have staffing problems, trouble filling all available positions. Is that something you've encountered in the veterinary world?
Definitely. It's definitely something that we're seeing. And people will often look at statistics of how many veterinarians we have, but it's also our support staff. It's our technicians, the people who greet you at the door. And we're seeing those shortages too, which is certainly exasperating the problem. And then I think that in general, the veterinary profession attracts very kind-hearted, empathetic people who want to give of their time. They desperately want to help these animals and the clients and people that are attached to them that love them. And so they're putting in more hours. They're trying to find more creative ways because nobody wants to have to put up a pet in need.
We're talking to Joelle Carson, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Veterinary Medical Association, looking at challenges facing veterinary clinics and their staff, animal hospitals, and pet owners as they try to get care for their pets. You can join in if you have an experience to share at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Michael is with us in Kaukauna. Michael, hi.
We had very good experience during the pandemic. We had two dogs that had to be put down because of age and illness. And one was just before the lockdown of the pandemic, and we were allowed to be with our poor Bert, through his last heartbeat. And then when Henry had to go was after the restrictions had lightened up. So I'm not fortunate they're gone, but fortunate we were able to be with them so they weren't afraid. And a lot of people do not like the idea of being with their dog to the last moment, but I felt that we owed that to them. And even during the pandemic, when we had to take the dog, Henry and the second one, they were very accommodating. We couldn't go in for the examination, but they were very good and very professional. And I appreciate our local clinic and what they did for us. And thanks for this time. I appreciate it.
Michael, thank you so much for calling. I'm sorry for the loss of your dogs, but I'm glad the experience went as well as it could in a tough time. Joelle, that issue of, the pet owner not being able to be in the room with the pet, whether it's getting treatment or, as our caller was talking about, when it's being put down, that's got to be hard for everybody involved, right?
It is very hard for everybody involved. I think most of our clients, it was based on clinic decision, but what Michael just described is what happened in most of our clinics.
I'm going to jump in. Your connection is breaking up for us a little bit, Joelle. So I think we're going to have a producer talk to you and maybe switch to our phone. In the meantime, we are talking to Joelle Carson, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Veterinary Medical Association. A lot of reports in the state and around the country of backlogs during the pandemic as people seek veterinary care. A lot of extra stress for veterinarians and clinic staff as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you work as a veterinarian or a staff member at an animal clinic, we would love to hear from you and how things are going for you. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And if you have an experience as a companion to a pet, what has the experience been like for you when you've needed to seek veterinary care? We're going to continue the conversation, hear from some more of you coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about veterinary care during the pandemic. Animal hospitals and clinics around the country are dealing with lower staffing levels in many cases, higher demand for appointments, a lot of overtime in some cases, angry or emotional pet owners. Joelle Carson is with us, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Veterinary Medical Association. You can join in with your stories on either side of this, whether you work in animal care or you're a pet owner who's needed that over this last year and a half or so. What has the experience been like for you? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Joelle, before we lost your connection, we were talking about the difficulties when that pet owner can't go into the room while the treatment is being provided. Tell us how tough that's been.
That's been really tough. It's tough for our veterinarians. It's tough for our animals. It's tough for the people who love them. And it's nobody's dream. That's for sure. But it's a clinic by clinic and area by county area decision. And most of our clinics, when it got to an end of life type of situation, they found a way to allow that client to be with that pet. I can't say 100% of the time that it happened, but our veterinarians really understand that importance for both the pet and for the client. So it's been tough, and we're all excited and looking forward to having that face-to-face in-person contact where we can.
Thanks again to Michael for calling in and sharing his experience at 800-642-1234. Let's go now to Dana with us in Madison. Dana, hello.
Hi there. I'm a veterinarian in the Madison area working in emergency and specialty hospitals. in our area, and I've been doing veterinary medicine for about 25 years, and it's never been like it's been the last couple of years with the pandemic. The stress level amongst our staff is very high because we really are, you know, every single shift is full tilt and over hours, and we can't see the number of the patients for the demand. And we've just had to make one of our hospitals go from 24-hour to urgent care because we don't have enough staff to take care of the pets in the demand that we have. And so we're really trying to prioritize patient care. I would encourage all owners also to really take a look at an organization called Not One More Veterinarian, which has a lot of information about the risk of suicide in our veterinary community. The Madison area has had lost several individuals in the last couple of years within our veterinary field to suicide. And I think it's really important to extend a lot of empathy and care to the people that are really trying to manage the best we can in this situation.
Dana, thank you so much for sharing your story. Best to you and your staff, and I hope you find some light at the end of the tunnel soon. And Joelle, that brings up something I was going to mention. Even these numbers are pre-pandemic concerns about suicide in the veterinary profession, the high stress. What do we know about that?
Well, let me back up real quick on something that Dana said that I think is important. She's talking about the stress that's being seen in our emergency and referral clinics, which I think is very important, because what has happened that's really exacerbated this is that with some of the backlogs that our clinics are trying to get through and see, sometimes what it happens is if somebody can't get into their local veterinarian on the day that they want, they're going to the emergency care hospitals. And a lot of times they're going there with non-urgent types of matters, which is then overwhelming our emergency care hospitals for our true emergencies. And it's tough. I mean, I have a dog that has crazy allergies, and when she gets to itching, I hate to see her like that, and I want to resolve it right in that moment. And there's times where that may be something I want to resolve right away, and my veterinarian can give me advice over the phone versus me taking them into an emergency clinic at that moment. So I think if we as the general public can help be cognizant of that and schedule our appointments in advance for the things we know that are coming up, the rabies, the flea and tick, those types of things, I think it'll help us get evened out and help alleviate some of that stress that's going around for all of us to share.
And then to that longer-term problem of stress for veterinarians and concerns about suicide risk, is that something you've been watching yourself, Joelle?
That's something that we're watching very, very closely and have been for years. It's something that our national association is looking at, our association is looking at. From a profession standpoint, it's something that we have to be cognizant about. Veterinarians have some of those risk factors. We're not necessarily the highest profession where suicide occurs, but we have some of those risk factors: high financial debt, lack of work-life balance, increased stress and overload of work hours. So how can we help? We're looking at, as a profession, how can we help offload some of those things from veterinarians so they don't feel as though that's an option?
Thanks again for that call, Dana, and bringing up a lot of big issues, actually, at 800-642-1234. Let's go now to Laura with us in Northwestern Wisconsin. Laura, hi.
Hello. I tuned into the conversation late, but I heard a fellow talking about being unable to be with his animal at the time of euthanasia, and I want to tell you that we had a vet actually came out to our vehicle to administer the shot, explained exactly what was going to happen. It was quite peaceful, and it was a great relief to see how peaceful it was. Of course, broke our hearts, but not allowing the animal owners to be there at the last minute, I don't think is a necessary thing.
Sure. Laura, thanks for the call. And Michael's conclusion was he actually was, because of the timing, able to be there with his animals. But point well taken. Laura, sorry for the loss of your dog. Glad, though, it went well. And again, as you were saying, when you heard from Michael, Joelle, veterinarians are trying to find a way, especially for that circumstance, the end of a pet's life, trying to find a way to make it so the owner can be there with, if they want to be.
Absolutely. Our veterinarians want people to be with their pets. They know that it's the best possible scenario for that pet in that moment, and it's the best possible scenario for the person as well. Nobody wants to take any of that away from them, and I have heard those types of creative solutions, and I'm so happy for Laura and for Michael that they were able to be there. That's just a meaningful moment, and it's wonderful. I'm so sorry for their loss, but I've heard those types of stories, and it just makes me so proud of all of the people that I work with, because they're trying to make those things happen in some really tough circumstances under the pandemic and restrictions.
Thanks a lot for sharing that story at 800-642-1234. Joelle Carson is with us, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Veterinary Medical Association, looking at the challenges faced by veterinarians and their staff at clinics and emergency animal hospitals. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question for our guest or an experience to share, if you work in that line yourself, or if you've had trouble or success in getting care for your pet over the last 16, 17 months or so. 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Joelle, you mentioned for your pet's allergy problems, you could do maybe a call with a veterinarian. I know it's harder with pets to do telemedicine than it is with humans in a lot of ways, but are there times when it is an option?
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up. We are actually working with our veterinary examining board right now to pass telehealth rules on and guidance, because right now there isn't any in the state of Wisconsin on how and when veterinarians can use telehealth medicine. So we're actually right in the process of figuring that out. I shouldn't say figuring that out, moving it forward.
Sure.
We need this innovation. We need this technology. But at the end of the day, we have to protect the animal and what's best for the animal, because they can't talk. They can't tell us that this hurts or the reason I'm panting is because I itch. So we're trying to make sure that we have the appropriate care. And when you call your veterinarian and you have that relationship and they have seen your pet and hands-on touched your pet and know that animal, they are the ones who can give you that guidance. So that first call should always be to your primary veterinarian to give you that advice. And sometimes it's hard to wait a day or 2 days to get in, but we're just trying to ask people to have patience on those preventative care pieces. If you know that your rabies vaccination for your dog is coming up in November, schedule it now. Pick up the phone and schedule it now instead of waiting until you get your third reminder and say, oh, I should go in December and do it. And get out there in advance and make those appointments early.
Now, when somebody does have to bring their pet in for something more urgent than that, or they've scheduled ahead that routine rabies shot or whatever it might be, do you have advice for the patients, or I guess the owners of the patients, on how to make the experience go as smoothly as possible?
I think it really depends on your animal. Mm. Like for me, I have a very reactive animal. She becomes so nervous and upset when she goes into a veterinary office. I love curbside. She does so much better if the veterinarian comes and takes her and brings her inside. So for me, I have her ready. I have her with her harness on. I have her with her leash ready to go. I have all of my questions prepared for my veterinarian before she goes into that clinic. And then I have those ways to talk to her on the back end. The support staff is really, really good in giving that information and helping you prepare if you have a cat that gets nervous and how you bring them in the carrier. But having your questions ready, because sometimes the technicians and the support staff can help answer some of those questions and then really save the medical ones that you need for the veterinarian when you're in the appointment.
How about not the pet behavior here, but the client, the pet owner's behavior? It's been an emotional time over the last year and a half in a lot of circumstances, and people really care about their pets, and it's understandable. Do you have things you'd want to say to the pet owners as they go into the veterinary clinic to dial it down and realize that the workers there are under a lot of stress too?
Yes, it's been a stressful time for everyone, and I know I've seen it in the grocery store. I hear about it on the news about fights happening on the planes because people's emotions are running so high during this pandemic. you add your best furry friend to that mix and scared and concerned over that friend, and your emotions just took an extra hit higher. And some people don't check those at the door. We want them to be emotional. We want them to care about their pets, but know that we do too. And every veterinarian there is working as hard as they can to help. So we hear you. We're trying. the more that you can work with us, the more that we can work with you. And know that your pet really connects with you. And so when you're anxious, they become anxious. When you're yelling, it makes them more anxious, and it's going to make everything go much harder. So if you can't kind of keep that in check for yourself or for the person that you're talking to, keep it in check for the pet that you're bringing in with you.
Before I let you go, I'm curious about the veterinarians and technicians of the future. How has this all impacted training for those would-be veterinarians and veterinary technicians? Is this getting in the way of getting them ready for their careers?
Last year was tough. I mean, it was tough for everyone. And we have an incredible veterinarian school. I mean, really, our school of veterinary medicine is top-notch, not only in the nation, but in the world. And they were very creative, as were many other schools around the nation. And so for those opportunities, they found ways to get them the training that they needed. And the veterinarians are educators by nature. And I love that about the veterinarians in our profession, is that they will take that time with those new grads that are coming in. They will show them anything that they're concerned that they missed, and they will make absolutely 100% sure that they are ready to work with any animal before they work with an animal. So there's probably some nerves around some of our new grads that went through that pandemic year of not having the year that they wanted to have. But I feel very confident in our experienced veterinarians and our new ones coming out that they will make sure that the necessary training either happened or it's happening in clinic at that moment.
Joelle, thanks again for joining us today.
Well, we appreciate you bringing this conversation to light. Thanks for having me.
Sure. That's Joelle Carson, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Veterinary Medical Association. We talked to her today about an added stress on animal hospitals and veterinarians during the pandemic and how we can help make the situation better for everyone, including our pets. Coming up after the news, you probably have a lot in common with the people you spend the most time with, coworkers, friends, classmates. A sociologist tells us to become increasingly rare that we spend time with people who are different than us, especially when it comes to income levels. I'm Rob Barrett. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, visit a Wisconsin clinic that helps treat people with sickle cell disease. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the amount of money you make can have a big impact on your social circles. That may always be true, but according to recent research, it's more true now than in recent history. Americans are less and less likely to interact with people from different income levels. That can make it hard to understand one another. It can also impact what you think other Americans' lives look like. One example, The Atlantic recently commissioned a study asking people what percentage of people still worked from home during the pandemic. The people who work remotely tended to massively overestimate how many other people were doing the same. Our next guest says interactions and experiences with people across income and wealth and racial lines are becoming increasingly rare. The result is that we normalize our own experiences and misunderstand one another. You can join in at 800-642-1234. When you think about your own circle of friends and coworkers and whatnot, do you interact much with people who make different amounts of money, a lot more or a lot less than you do? Did it used to be different in your life, do you think? Do you worry that we just don't know much about each other anymore if we're not interacting with each other? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Jonathan Meiss teaches sociology at Boston University and is working on a book tentatively titled The Inequality Paradox, Why the Growing Gap Leaves Us Less Concerned. Jonathan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, John. Rob.
Let's talk about that example I just gave from The Atlantic. You're quoted in that piece. Those work-from-home people, they're a particular type of job, and they kind of assume, since they move in circles similar to their own, that a lot of people, everybody's in that kind of position. Is this an example of the kind of misjudgment we can make when we don't interact with people different than ourselves?
No, that's absolutely right. There's a lot of research showing that we hold a lot of misperceptions when it comes to matters of economic inequality. We tend to sort of draw on our own experiences, on what we know from people around us, our loved ones, our family, our neighbors, and sometimes project their experiences and our experiences to the entire society that we live in, and kind of infer or conclude that most people must be going through something similar. Now, when we surround ourselves with people with the same kind of levels of education we have, roughly same levels of income, et cetera, then the world that we inhabit looks very different from our society, but we're unable to see that difference.
Can you talk about the trends over time when it comes to how much we segregate ourselves socioeconomically? How much worse have things gotten over the last few decades?
Yeah, so with former students of mine, we asked basically ourselves, we know that economic inequality has really grown in the last 30, 40 years, but what about socioeconomic segregation? So what about the extent to which people from different income levels, different ends of the social ladder, if you will, are they interacting with each other? Are they meeting each other at the same rate now as they did some 40 some years ago? Or in other words, like, how did growing inequality, how did that impact sort of our social lives and spatially sort of how we're situated? And what we find is that people of different sort of in different income groups are less and less likely to interact with each other, to be in the same workplaces, less likely to live in the same neighborhoods, increasingly go to different schools, but also their social networks, like the friends that they have, the romantic partners that they find, also increasingly come from kind of the same economic backgrounds. So that means that, again, the world that we inhabit looks a lot more like us than the true diversity of our society.
What's driving that? Are we sorting ourselves out? As I've heard from some other studies, are we sorting ourselves out by where we live? And is that a big driver of this?
Yeah, that's absolutely a big factor here, right? So processes like gentrification that are pricing people out of certain neighborhoods. There's also a degree of think of it as higher stakes when it comes to, for instance, basically an increased competition for attending the right kind of schools that really pay off and help you in the rest of your career. Whereas it used to be that just having a college degree was sort of a guarantee for middle class life. That's no longer the case. It's all about which college you go to, what kind of credentials you have. But yeah, it's really interesting how people have come to increasingly sort themselves. For instance, when it comes to romantic relationships, when it comes to dating, why education and why income has become a bigger factor in that process. I think that's an open question, but clearly, that is the process that we're seeing.
We're talking to Jonathan Meiss from Boston University, sociologist there. We're looking at income inequality in the United States, but not just the money part of it, the socializing part of it. People from different economic backgrounds over time are hanging out with each other less, working with each other less, going to school together less, marrying each other less. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you fighting that trend? Do you have a social setting where you hang out with people from different backgrounds than you? What is it? What makes it work for you? Did you marry across the bounds of class? Or do you see this happening in your life, this sorting out? Do you see it as a problem? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jonathan, I wonder how aware people would be that this is even happening, because I think on the world stage, Americans are known for not talking about class, not talking a lot about how much money we make. How much of this is happening without people even really noticing it?
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, there's a couple of things that sort of make it so that a lot of people don't really care about growing economic inequality. Part of it is that most Americans think of themselves as being in the middle class, even though they're close or at what government considers to be the poverty line. A lot of people still identify as middle class. Not a lot of people think of themselves as poor, as working class. And another part is that there still is pretty widespread belief in the American dream. This idea that if only you work hard enough, you're going to make it somehow. So that if you don't find yourself in, you know, perfect economic circumstances today, maybe that'll change tomorrow. You got to sort of have some faith in that. So that's something that maybe keeps people from being too concerned or too worried. Whether that's the reality, that's a whole nother matter, of course. But my research suggests that beyond these factors, the fact that the economic divide has sort of become a social divide, that really makes it harder for us to have a good understanding of what other people's lives across the economic divide look like. It makes it harder for us to develop empathy, solidarity. And that is, that's a serious problem, I think, leading to people really underestimate just how much inequality there really is.
Staying with the impact side of things, one thing on my mind a lot is, what if you have one profession like, say, the media, where a lot of people come from similar backgrounds, similar economic backgrounds in particular? I think back, you know, post-World War II, the GI Bill brought a lot of working class people into the media. There may not be that road anymore. A lot of times it's unpaid internships that people can't afford if they don't have the money to live without an income. Do you worry if a group like the media has this tunnel vision because they're not coming from different backgrounds?
Yeah, I think that could be the case. I mean, obviously, as journalists, as academics, part of the job is challenging yourself, challenging your preconceptions, and putting yourself out in sort of different situations, seeking out new information, right? So that's, I think, very much part of what you're supposed to be doing as a good journalist, as well as a good academic. But we are ourselves subject to these same processes. In Boston too, you know, like that's also a city that's very much socioeconomically segregated, where the people that I encounter on a daily basis at the university, but also in my neighborhood, are also like not a great representation of the, you know, actual diversity of our society. So it takes a lot of work actually to sort of break through cross these kind of socioeconomic fault lines, because so much of our society has been organized based on these economic principles.
We're talking with Jonathan Mice. He teaches sociology at Boston University, working on a book tentatively titled The Inequality Paradox, Why the Growing Gap Leaves Us Less Concerned. We're talking about why we tend to misunderstand the experiences of other Americans as economic inequality grows and we don't associate with one another if we have different economic backgrounds. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel this ever in your life, that you have this kind of bubble of people who are at least somewhat similar in how you grew up? Do you have some venue in your life where you meet people from other walks of life? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation, hear from you, take some of your calls coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Jonathan Mice, assistant professor of sociology at Boston University. He's with us to talk about growing levels of economic inequality and why we don't associate with people different than ourselves that much and the impact that can have. You can join in with your own story at 800-642-1234 or your questions, 800-642-1234. Let's go to our callers now. Randy is with us in Ripon. Randy, hi.
Hi. Boy, this is a great subject. I was thinking about while I was waiting here is our previous president really spoke at a level that appealed to a lot of lower class, blue collar. I'm going to come across as probably, I don't know, judgmental here, but I can see, and I'm blue collar myself, and I can see how that appealed to a lot of, you know, lesser educated folks that feel as though they're being talked down when you use syllable word verbiage with them. And I think that appealed to them, even though, you know, he was educated, but, and he was obviously wealthy, but I think it has a lot to do with education as well. And I think that also plays a role. I don't know if it's so much wealth. But
Randy, thanks a lot for the call. Breaking up a little bit there. But Jonathan, I mean, are we speaking a different language to some extent between one socioeconomic group and another, as our caller's kind of pointing to there?
Oh, there's definitely some sort of elitism. You see that in politics, in science, in journalism, that perhaps doesn't make it easier. But I think the real sort of important thing that that disconnects people is that there are just fewer opportunities for interactions in, you know, fewer sort of communal meeting grounds, public places. It's just harder to just run into people from different walks of life. And the pandemic obviously hasn't made things any better.
Thanks a lot for that call, Randy, at 800-642-1234. We'll go to JJ now in Madison. JJ, hi.
Hello. So I guess I have a lot more than I could really ask on the radio show, and I'll just have to buy the book and read it when it comes out. But I was wondering two specific things. First off, is this, like, specifically an American issue? Has there been any kind of study into the European countries or Eastern countries about if they have the same social divide as they do comparatively and economically? And then the other part is, what's the way back out of it? How do we start being a homogenous group again, besides, like, you know, fixing income inequality? Is there really any way to do anything about it besides, you know, making people have similar levels of pay and education?
JJ, two big questions there, Jonathan. First of all, that international perspective, are we unique at this in the United States, or are other, especially so-called developed countries, experiencing the same thing?
Yeah, those are really great questions, JJ. I kind of assumed that maybe this was an American issue. I mean, the United States is definitely known for having really high levels of wealth inequality and income inequality compared to other nations. And those are really, really strongly tied with economic segregation, educational segregation. I think I should test this assumption. So I started working on this project with a colleague in Sweden. Many of us know Sweden to be a very egalitarian country. But in fact, Sweden in the last 25 years or so has also grown increasingly unequal, economically speaking. So we asked, has this sort of increase in inequality in Sweden, this very different setting, has that gone hand in hand with growing rates of segregation, of a greater disconnect between rich and poor in this society as well, socially speaking, spatially speaking? And our preliminary evidence suggests that yes, it has, that we're seeing a very similar process in a very dissimilar context.
And then the question of what we do about it. It doesn't seem like an easy boat to turn here.
Yeah, so I think JJ put it as a question of how do we get more homogeneous. I think maybe the problem is actually that many of our social sort of networks and environments are actually much more homogeneous than the diversity and heterogeneity of our society is. And we kind of need to think about maybe ways of making our networks, making our neighborhoods, making our schools and our workplaces more heterogeneous. And I think that is that really, like I was saying before, requires more investment in public places and meeting grounds. It requires more efforts to integrate, socioeconomically speaking, schools, neighborhoods, bring people from various walks of life together so they can learn from each other. They can see what other people's lives are like. I think that would be a great step in the right direction.
Thanks for that call, Richard. We're talking to Jonathan Mize, sociologist at Boston University, looking at economic inequality in the United States and why people from different economic backgrounds are less and less likely over time to interact with each other in a lot of different ways. Back to your calls now with Denny in Wapaka. Denny, hi.
Hi. You know, I just wanted to say I'm an older fella. I still run my business. I know people on both sides of the political aisle, all ages, from teenagers to into their 80s, and economic persuasion, and it is stunning to me about how little they know about each other. I go to two different craft breweries. One is all on the right side of the aisle, the other's all on the left side of the aisle. And how you get people talking to each other, I'm open to suggestions. I just heard your guest, and we got to figure it out.
Well, you'd think, Denny, the shared love of craft beer might be an opening. Do you think there's something there?
I try to go to both breweries and love it either way. So for me, it works.
Denny, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Well, we even sort ourselves out, Jonathan, by our favorite craft breweries. But Denny's pointing to this as a political divide as well. Do you think that's part of the problem here, that because we don't know people from different economic groups, this might be part of our partisan divide as well?
Yeah, I do think it feeds into partisan divides. There's pretty compelling research that suggests that a typical Democrat and a typical Republican kind of have different fallback positions, sort of take on a whole different set of assumptions about what it means, for instance, for a person to be poor, why that person has gotten into that situation requiring need. And it's the way that people's assumptions then sort of help them make sense of the situation that leads them to oppose or support, government intervention. But once you start sort of taking away those assumptions and actually giving people an understanding of what's happening in any given situation or to any given person, those political differences start fading away, and people agree on a whole lot more than they do in the absence of sharing the same experience and having the same information.
Thanks for that call. And just our last minute, I've talked to people who have made on the show, who have made efforts to try to bring together people of different backgrounds. And it sounds cool and all, but is that just yelling at the tide to try to make it go the other way? Is this something that we're not going to be able to turn back just with sort of individual efforts like that?
I mean, I think it starts with sort of venturing into different spaces, whether that's the brewery. I play a lot of soccer, and I play soccer with anyone who's interested in playing soccer. I meet people from countries all over the world all the time. And I think those are really important activities that can bring people together.
Jonathan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Jonathan Mize teaches sociology at Boston University and is working on a book tentatively titled The Inequality Paradox, Why the Growing Gap Leaves Us Less Concerned. We've been talking about why people from different economic backgrounds over time are less and less likely to interact with one another, work together, go to school together, marry one another. Still time to share your story. Do you have a place in your life where you do meet a lot of people from different backgrounds? What is it? How does it go? Do you feel good that it's a part of your life? You can email us, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. Love to hear your story. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, Wisconsin schools call police to deal with students at twice the national rate, according to a new report. We'll find out what is driving that and how some districts are looking for alternatives. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. And this is a great theme. A cookbook author shares recipes for meals. Wait. and for another meal you can cook with the leftovers from that first recipe. We'll get some great advice. Maybe you can share your own leftover tactics along the way. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Time now for a squirrel update. As we mentioned on the show a couple weeks back, squirrels get kind of zany this time of year, in part because they're out looking for food and places to stash that food for the future. And black walnuts are dropping, a great squirrel snack. In years past, I have found squirrel-hidden walnuts in cunning hiding places, like wedged in the doorknob of my front screen door, or set in a potted plant that I'm about to put away for the winter. But that's nothing. A truck owner in North Dakota had a real payload of black walnuts hidden under the hood of his pickup this year, to the tune of 42 gallons worth. As reported by the Washington Post, the Fargo, North Dakota resident actually expected to see walnuts under the hood of his truck, because it happens every 2 years. That matches the walnut production cycle of his neighbor's walnut tree. It all comes down, apparently, to the work of one red squirrel who thinks the guy's Chevy Avalanche is the ultimate treasure vault. In alternate years, the truck owner has gotten into the habit of opening the hood and clearing out the walnuts before he starts the engine. This year was different. For one thing, he tried parking further away from the tree. No luck. For another, the squirrel was way more industrious than in years past, with thousands of walnuts stowed away, not just under the hood either. It filled up every bit of space it could find there, and it wedged them behind the fenders, requiring the removal of said fenders to get the walnuts out. Has that ever happened to you? Tell us about it. Send pictures. Email ideas@WPR.org. Squirrel news you can use. This is Central Time.